Well, as we sit here, Europe either is or is not at the brink of collapse. Greece either is or is not descending into anarchy. And how you could tell probably is a question for Greece. And the issue of sovereign debt is first, front, and center on the world. There will be restructurings. And after there are restructurings, there will be disputes. And the disputes will be framed by, even if they're compromised in settlements, they'll be framed by the law of investment state dispute rules, particularly the ICSID mechanism run by a member of the World Bank family. So we couldn't have a better speaker today to talk about the most gripping issues facing us and our future, I would say, for the next 10 to 20 years than Mr. Ko Yung Tung. Mr. Tung, I regret to say, is a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School, but he's been working his way up since then. After a distinguished career in practice, he became the general counsel of the World Bank, and alongside that also the General Secretary of the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, ICSID, which is the World Bank mechanism for managing investor disputes with sovereign defaulters. Since then, he has been in practice with Morrison and Forster, as well as holding down a number of important positions in the NGO world, and also being a lecturer at Yale Law School, which is not quite as good as Virginia, but a pretty good school, better than Harvard. So I'm delighted to introduce Mr. Ko Yung Tung.
All right. Can you see this thing? All right, because I will be using PowerPoint. This is my outline, and so if you follow that, you'll get what I'm saying. You don't have to take notes. I think I'll put something on the online thing so that you'll have the guts of what I'm about to say. I really wanted to come to UVA. I was trying to manufacture a way of coming down because my son is here at a 2L, so I couldn't just say, "Dad is coming down to see you," so I said, "Oh, I have to get an invitation." And I talked to a friend, and then the friend talked to the dean of the law school, and here I am under the auspices of the Virginia Journal of International Law and the J.B. Moore Society of International Law. So I'm grateful for the sponsors, and I'm grateful that you guys are here. You know, this is indeed my first time to this law school. And when my son was at college, and then he finally said, "I think I want to go to law school," I was very happy about this, thinking that he was going to be following my footsteps. And then he said, so I said, "Oh, that's good. Where are you applying?" He said, "UVA." So I said, "Okay, that's a very fine law school. Where else?" He said, "No, just UVA." And I said, "Well, it might be a good idea to apply to more than one law school." He said, "Well, maybe." I said, "Well, there's Columbia, there's even Yale, there's Harvard." He said, "No, I want to go somewhere warm." I said, "Well, there's Emory, there's Duke, there's Stanford." He said, "No, I just want to go to UVA." I said, "Why?" He says, "Well, that's the best law school there is." So he came here. And so that's why I'm here, to the best law school. And I can tell that it really is. I'm very, very impressed. Now, when I was talking, trying to figure out, now that I got the invitation, I have to figure out what am I going to talk about, and then we correspond. And then basically, Courtney said, "You can talk either about the World Bank or about ICSID." So I said, "Either is fine with me, you choose," and she chose ICSID. And then the flyer came out and said, "Mr. Tung will talk about the World Bank and ICSID." So now you're going to get two mushed together, so you will forgive me that I have to cover a large territory in a very limited amount of time. I will start here because this is very, very important for you to know the international architecture under which international financial instruments, law, and dispute resolution operate. Now, during after, well, even before the end of World War II, when the end was pretty near in sight, the leader said, what are we going to do after this horrible, horrible disaster is over? And they say, well, it must never happen again. Never again, they said. And one of the things we need is some institution that will promote peace and stability and avoid wars. And they came up with the UN, as you know. The next thing they said is, what we need is we have to restore, reconstruct the bombed out countries like France, Germany, Japan, and that needed reconstruction. And then also we have to help the struggling economies of newly independent former colonies, and that's the World Bank. And then they needed something that would avoid the Great Recession of the 30s, as well as the rampant inflation in Germany, which they thought contributed to its bellicose ways. And then they came up with the IMF. And fourthly, they said, for global prosperity, we need to have more international trade. And they came out with General Agreement for Tariffs and Trade GATT, which transformed into the WTO. So these are the four pillars on which international economic and financial, as well as world peace, rest. Now, so I have to go to, the Bretton Woods, we know, are the twin institutions, the World Bank and IMF, born in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. One of the important things here is that they thought at this point that international investment is going to be the key driver for prosperity and peace, and that's the role that the World Bank has. Now, it's a rare combination of being a treaty organization. It has 187 member countries now, and therefore, like the UN, it's a totally separate treaty organization, not subject to any laws except for public international law. Second, it's a development agency, which means what? It lends money, you know, very, very concessionary level to foster economic development in order to reduce poverty around the world. Third is a financial institution. It has money. Many people misunderstand. The World Bank is like a normal bank. How do banks raise money? Well, today they do funny things. But in the olden days, they took in deposits. But the main way that you raise money as a bank is you issue bonds. The World Bank's business model is very, very simple. They issue bonds around the world. Financial institutions, as well as moms and pops, you can go online and buy yourself a $100 World Bank bond. And it pays one of the lowest rates because it's backed by 187 countries. Most of them don't matter that much, but they are key countries like the United States, UK, Japan, backing this. So it gets a AAA rating. So it gets the lowest rate. And then what do? They lend that on at only 1% over that. Cost of funding plus 1%, they lend that, they make money on it. Actually, the World Bank is a money-making operation. Now, so just very, very quickly, because I am not, when we talk about the World Bank, there are various parts of it. There's IBRD, the main bank. There's IFC, which lends to the private sector. The bank lends only to a country, to the sovereign. There's IDA, which lends to the poorest countries, countries that have per capita income about $1.50 per capita. That's about, if the country is that level, you get concessionary loans, which essentially is interest-free loan. Then we have ICSID that we will go into, and lastly you have MIGA, which guarantees against sovereign risks. Now, this is part of a slide I do for the World Bank talk. But the main thing is that in its purposes, it highlights private foreign investment. The original Articles of Agreement does not bold these words, but I did this for your purpose. Now, when we talk about bank, we talk about clients. And the clients of the World Bank include these people, I go this, you just memorize this, it'll be online. But you see that the issues confronting the World Bank is horrendous. It's not getting any better. So one, usually I do a head count of how many people would have died without water, without vaccine, without food, etc. In 1 hour talk, which ours is, and you get into millions of people. So that you can see that what they do, despite all the criticism of the World Bank, it does a very, very important mission. In the year 2000, they came up with something called the MDGs, because everybody's throwing money and they said, we're not fighting poverty, we need everybody to be on the same page. They came up with so-called the MDGs, which are the 7 goals. And they have targets to meet by the year 2014, and we are, what, only 4 years away from that target date, and we are far from meeting these objectives. Now, one of the things I do at Yale, because they're not as smart as you are, I do a thing called Development Economics 101 for Dummies. Now, this comes out of Sachs's book. But you can see that the population of the world is basically flat from the time of Jesus Christ to about 1800 or so. And all of a sudden, it goes up. Now, you say, how come? What happened around there? You know, Viagra was discovered only recently, so that cannot be the reason. So, of course, you guys know the answer. It's the Industrial Revolution. But if the population goes up, but so does income. Per capita income, again, flat, flat, flat for thousands of years, and all of a sudden, population growth, per capita income jumps up due to Industrial Revolution. Now, so we say, whoopee, yay. Except when you look at regions, you will notice that, say, in right at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, 1820, per capita, GDP per capita, does not differ that much, because most places are going through subsistence economy. You make, you eat, you whatever. Yet, 180 years later, you see the difference. U.S. and Africa. Big, big difference. Difference of 14 times. What happened? Why over this 180 years? The difference in annual growth, 1.7, 0.7, only 1% per year over 180 years is the difference between Africa today and the United States today. That 1%. And where do you get that 1%? Of course, I want to say foreign investment, but it's not all the answer. But you will see if, as you go forward, foreign investment becomes a huge part of the world economy. You cannot avoid it. Now, and it shows you where it's going. Obviously, developed countries, the rich countries get most of the money. They give the most of the money, and they get the most. For poor countries, remember the MDGs, they need money for them to fight HIV, fight malnutrition, whatever. So you see where they get the money. Many people think it is ODA, foreign assistance. But official flows, which is ODA, is pretty small compared to FDI, foreign investment. So how do you get foreign investment to come into your country, whether you are Timor-Leste or you're Democratic Republic of Congo? That is the game that everybody's playing. Now, who provides this money? Here are the usual suspects, the rich big countries. U.S. is way up there. Who gets them? Again, the rich people. So, because, why? The Belgians want to invest in the United States, they buy portfolio investment, they buy buildings, they invest into R&D companies in Silicon Valley. So the poor countries don't get much of this thing. The biggest so-called third world country that gets much of the money, like almost three quarters, is China. So we get to this topic of foreign investment treaties. They're called BITs, bilateral investment treaties, or DD, this is double taxation treaties, and other IIAs, international investment agreements. Oh, how many of you are taking this ICSID course here? Okay, you guys can all go to sleep after this point. But you will see that there are over 6,000 of these IIAs. They're just floating around. Now, you will also see who has the most IIAs. The ones, Germany, as you know, is an export engine. Those who export goods also export money, and they enter into these. And so, again, it's basically among rich, the rich countries have this, and then we're, so that most of them, these bits, are between rich countries and poor countries, as you can see. The reason is, if it's between, say, two rich developed countries, you don't need a special treaty. They say, okay, if I'm going to invest in, I was going to say France, but I would change that, Australia, because we have an Australian though, then I don't need a special treaty because I can rely on the laws of Australia, and if I have a problem, I can rely on their court system. But if I'm going to be investing in, say, Timor-Leste, then you say, I'm not sure the laws are developed enough, I'm not sure what my rights are, I'm not sure that I can enforce my contract, I'm not sure I'll ever get paid. And so these four countries enter into bits to say, I will give you protection so that you will provide money to us. Okay, so what do they cover? We hear what we'll do for your investment. If we expropriate, there are standards for that. You can transfer your money in and out, and if there's dispute, we'll provide a mechanism outside our domestic system. So most of you already know this. They say for foreign investment, we'll give you national treatment. We won't treat you any worse than we treat our own nationals. Moreover, we will not treat you any worse than other countries, other foreign investors from other countries. And we will be fair and equitable. We'll give you full protection and security. These are all buzzwords, by the way. Minimum international law standards will be observed. We won't be arbitrary. We won't discriminate against you. And if we expropriate, it'll be for public purpose. It will be non-discriminatory. We'll do it across the board. There'll be due process of law, and we'll give you full, adequate compensation paid promptly. So that's the rule. Okay. Now we have about 2,600 bits floating around. Remember, there's 6,000 of the IIAs. So now you have a mechanism where a private investor can bring a legal proceeding against a sovereign nation. A novelty. In the olden days, basically, sovereigns will take on the role of its investor and have a claim, right? But this is private versus public. So ICSID was formed in 1966. Again, remember foreign investment, how do we get that going? And said, all right, we will provide a forum and procedure where foreign investors can bring arbitration, binding arbitration, against host states.
So they said, what do we need? We need cooperation for development. This is from the applicant. If there's a dispute, then we'll provide this mechanism.
The jurisdiction is very, very broad.
So long as there's a legal dispute arising directly out of an investment between a contracting state and another contracting state, national off, and then parties have consented. And there's something called additional facility,
which made it even wider because only one of the party had to be a signatory to the exit convention.
So now we need investments, we have bids. Where there's investments, there are disputes. So here are the arbitration. Again, you can see how fast it goes up. Now, this is the red is exit, non-exit, because there are other forums, as you know, London, Stockholm, ICC, and the like. And I understand Professor Stefan is involved in a Stockholm proceeding. I want to concentrate on exit. Exit, as you can see, when I was Secretary General in these years, until then, the average filing was something like one a year. It was a sleepy little place. Nothing really happened, but we had great lunches and dinner. Then all of a sudden, kaboom, you know? I leave and the place falls down. What's happening? Financial crises, right? We had the Mexican financial crisis, we had the Asian flu, we had the Russian flu, we had the Argentine one, we had the Great Recession that we're still in. Iceland and Ireland teeter, they're sort of back on their feet. Now we have Greece and we're not where Greece is heading. Perhaps we'll find out on Friday. And then the fate of Greece also affects all these other
countries on the periphery of the Eurozone. So these are serious things that affect not only these countries, poor people, but also all of us.
It will affect your tuition here, I think. Now,
I want to now go over to Argentina because I want to discuss four specific cases. And before this, I have to give you a background because the facts on all four of the cases are almost exactly the same. The laws are the same.
What happened?
Argentina, they used to say about Brazil, Brazil is a country of the future, and it always will be. Well, Argentina was similar. Argentina, at the turn of the 20th century, was the sixth richest country in the world. People forget this. It is blessed with natural resources, great land, great natural resources, timber, oil, what have you, a very well-educated population, and a great city. You know, Buenos Aires is known as the Paris of Latin America. It's a beautiful place. Yet, due to all kinds of things, in the late 80s and early 90s, they went through deep recession with hyperinflation. So what happens is IMF comes right in with his white hat and says, you've got to do certain things about this for your economy. And this is sort of the part of the Washington Consensus. There's a framework for privatization. Too much of your services are done by the public sector, so you should privatize. In order to confront the inflation, they create a currency board and peg the Argentine peso to the US dollar. One peso was equal to one US dollar, no matter what. They privatize, Gas del Estado, we'll get into this. And they passed these various laws. And in order to get, as you privatize, you want investors, both domestic and foreign investors. So
Argentina joins ICSID, signs various bids, including one with the United States. They privatized Gasdo Estado into 10 units, and foreign investors started to invest into this sector. Everything was fine. Argentina's economy started to boom. It became the model poster child for the Washington Consensus. See, our recipe works. Then, a decade later, end of about the year 2000 or so, but you will see GDP compared with the rest of Latin America, Latin America going happily up. Argentina, this promising country, keeps on going down. In terms of investment, look at this. Nobody wants to invest in Argentina. So the World Bank were thinking, oh my gosh, they're going down the tank. Poverty is about $2 per person per day. This is extreme poverty at this point is measured at $1 a day per person. Over 50% of the people of Argentina all of a sudden was poor, as defined by less than $2 a day. Riots, looting, and dozens killed. Horrible situation. During this time, I remember I dealt with five presidents in 6 weeks. They kept on changing every week. So what they do is they declare emergency. Remember that in the gas field, because I'll be talking about four cases, it was all denominated in U.S. dollars. The tariff that would be charged to consumers would be in dollars, and then dollars and pesos didn't make any difference, remember. And so then the rate would go up based on U.S. inflation rates, the producer price index, PPI. Not what was happening in Argentina, where the prices kept on dropping, the U.S. was going up, so it became horrible to keep it up. So they basically said, no more future semi-annual PPI adjustments. Tariffs will now be done in pesos and not in dollars. Corralito, you may remember, basically said, now you can't take your money and send it over to Italy where your uncle lives. Companies couldn't take their money out, and then, as I said, the musical chair of presidents happened. Then they passed this thing called the emergency law and delinks the peso from the dollar. Immediately, the peso dropped 70%, hence what you had. And remember, if you had a peso account, it was the same as a dollar account. But all of a sudden, it was worth only 30%. They have to renegotiate all the licenses with the gas companies. And then Nestor Kirchner, the current president's husband, comes in, and things start to stabilize. Oops, backwards, sorry. Then, more than 40 cases are filed against Argentina due to this emergency law and all the measures that they take. And then I'll be talking about four of these cases, because they're all the same. Same background facts. They all invested into one or the other of the 10 privatized gas companies, whether they were for transportation or distribution. Now, it all turns on this little bitty provision of the U.S.-Argentine bid. The claimants basically say, we've been treated unfairly and unequitably. You have expropriated our investment. You have discriminated all these. Argentina says, no, we didn't do any of those. But even if we did, we have this necessity, what they call non-precluded measures, NPM. It's very simple. The treaty precludes any measures that are necessary for the maintenance of public order and protection of its essential, you know, essential security. So they said, this is our get out of jail card. We're okay. We are absolved, whatever you guys say. Now, the scholars on this are on two sides. It is very divided, very, very controversial. Here in your journal, Courtney, you have a very good piece that basically takes position that Article 11 of the BIT does absolve Argentina from its obligations under the treaty. And then you have Jose Alvarez of NYU basically saying, no, 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 that's not what Article 11 says. It's split. So that, you know, for law students, whenever you're confronted with an exam, it's always issue spotting, right? How many issues can I spot from this little provision? So here are some of them. From that little word, is it self-executing? Which means, who decides that there is an essential national interest that is making allowing us to take these measures? Who decides whether or not these are necessary or not? Self-executing basically means the country gets to do it, and then the arbitrators or other people can't deal with that. Is it a lex specialis? Is it a special law? Which means that, you know, special laws take precedence over general law, the way you construct agreements and international law. And how should it be interpreted? Using the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties and the International Law Commission on State Responsibility. And does essential security interests include economic crisis, or is it only about the existence of the state itself, the sovereignty? Well, what do you mean by necessary? You know, and even if measures, non-precluded measures, say it is, but does that mean, okay, you're allowed to do this, but you still have to pay for it? Or does it mean you're allowed to do it, and you don't have to pay for it? These are all the issues that divide arbitrators, awards, and scholars. Some of the cases basically say, okay, that little provision, Article 11, is too vague. We don't know what you mean by necessary, about essential national interests. So we must turn to customary international law. And customary international law is embodied in the ILC state responsibility article. And Article 25 says, it's phrased in the negative, necessity cannot be invoked, okay, unless you meet all of it. That is the only way to safeguard grave and imminent health, blah, 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 and that the state has not contributed to that situation. So what happens in the three of the four cases, in CMS, SEMPRA, and Enron, the tribunal, the first one, basically said, yep, Argentina was wrong. They violated all these things. And not only this, Article 11 doesn't apply for these reasons. Among them, it wasn't necessary. It wasn't the only way. There were other ways you could have done it. LG&E, on the other hand, find the same thing, except that, however, we Article 11 does apply. It's a non-precluded measure. And then they cite these facts. Totally different result. Then, under ICSID, there is this very curious provision called annulment. It says, an arbitral award may be annulled if one of these four conditions. Usually we're talking about manifestly exceeded its powers, or failure to state reasons. So we go into round two for these. CMS Annulment Committee, by the way, the committee is made up of three different people, basically appointed by the Secretary General of ICSID, not by the Department. And this committee basically says, yeah, the tribunal really screwed up. You know, they made lots of errors. However, they say, we are not an appeals court. If we were, we would have probably reversed and have different ones. So they basically say, although there are lots of errors and defects in your reasoning and the application of law, we're not an appeals court, so we let the award stand. This became, everybody became very, very upset that the annulment committee shouldn't be criticized. They should either annul or not annul, period. Not be like a professor marking your paper. SEMPRA basically says, no, tribunal, you got it totally wrong. Article 11 is a standalone one. It's a threshold one. If you're exempted under Article 11, you're home safe no matter what. So we're not going to even look at whether or not you violated fair equitable treatment, etc. It's self-executed. Argentina decided they did, and hence, fine. And we won't even look at the ILC because Article 11 is clear enough and it operates on its own. Enron, on the other hand, says, no, we're annulling the whole thing because they got the whole thing wrong. They said, okay, it's okay that you look at ILC Article 25, but give me a break, they say. The only way? It says, ILC said, if it's the only way to come back to necessity. But they say, well, you relied on an economist. This is a legal term, not an economic one, etc. So for these reasons, the whole thing is annulled. I want to get to this. As we're discussing that, and we're getting out of time, one of the interesting things is that the U.S.-Argentine bid was signed in 2001. In 2004, U.S. comes out with its new model. It always has a model. And in it, it has a non-precluded measures provision, which says, upon a measure that it considers, which makes it very, very clear that it's self-executing, which means the party state gets to decide. Right after they signed Argentina, which didn't have this, U.S. signed a bid with Russia, basically, and had this provision. So the question is, when they put this in, did they mean, oh, I really meant that in the Argentine bit, but we didn't put it in, so we're correcting it, or they're saying, we didn't mean it was self-executing, now we're changing our position, hence we're putting it, nobody knows. Hence, lawyers are all excited. So the situation right now is very confusing because there are so many regimes going on here. These are only some, and people call this a spaghetti bowl. And on top of these, you have 2,600 bits. So many criticisms on the investment regime scheme, there are some of them, and then some of the things that people are talking about is revising the bid, having real appellate court, just like in the WTO proceedings, et cetera, but again, you can read about it, think about it later, and because I want to take the rest of the time for Q&A, which may be related to this or may not, whatever questions you have, I will entertain, and if I can, I will answer them. So that's it for now. Thank you.